essentially using very reliant upon a PowerPoint. So there you go. All right, now how much time do I have? How much have I lost? All right, 2 minutes. So we're not that bad. All right. So howdy, howdy. How you doing? Good to see you in person.
Good to see you.
Yeah.
I have my coffee, so I can stay awake.
Awesome. Well, that's still saying a lot. I'm just going to put it that way. All right. Yeah, no pressure. No, but I mean, actually, if there's 10 people still awake at the end of this presentation, I will consider that a success. All right. No, it's amazing, I think, but other people might disagree. There's just that problem. No, I'm not going to be one of those 10 people, that's for sure, which might end up making those other 10 people be awake because they're waiting for me to fall over, but that'll be interesting nevertheless. All right, so the problem of evil, I got that for the title. I know in the handout it's something slightly different. I think in the handout it's the evidential and or the logical and evidential problems of evil, which is a whole lot to try to cover in one presentation. In fact, actually, when I lecture on this, I teach at a community college, and when I lecture on this, this is usually going to be at least 3 one-hour lectures. So I got told I have only 2 hours. All right. So I'm going to try to condense it to that amount for you guys. But also, I like that they gave me the 11 o'clock slot, which if any slot of the day is supposed to let out early, it's the 11 o'clock one because lunch is immediately following, and nobody wants to be late for their lunch. So we've got to let out just a little bit early for that. Also, at some point, this will be entertaining, and for no other reason than because I'm going to trip over that cord at some point. So you guys can be waiting for that. But all the information I'm going to be talking about today is actually found, if you guys are interested in a book for this, it's actually found, this is an older edition, but in the Oxford Readings in the Philosophy of the Problem of Evil, basically. If you're interested in a book on all of this stuff, it's that book. If you want to take a look at it in up close by the end of the presentation, just come on up here and I'll let you look at it. But this problem has a few things I need to qualify up front, all right? So I need to be pedantic here for just a second. There are two types of problems of evil that we can distinguish between up front, and that is that the first one is more of an emotional problem, which is that people will want an answer that will be emotionally satisfying on some level. And then the second one is a philosophical problem, which is where we can provide some sort of a reasoned answer to it. But the problem with the philosophical answer is that it may not actually bring any sort of emotional satisfying answer. All right, it may not be comforting. All right, so we have to make that distinction up front. And I'm going to be focusing entirely on the philosophical problem of evil. All right, and Stephen can critique me because we were in a class on the problem of evil very recently together. And if I go wrong anywhere, he can just stand up and throw his coffee at me. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. All right. So two more distinctions that need to be made is that dealing with the philosophical problem, there are two types again. All right. And so the two types of philosophical problems are the logical problem and the evidential problem. Now, given these, they are different problems in the way that we reason about them. One is deductive, the logical problem, and the other is inductive, the experiential problem, all right, or the evidential problem. It goes by both names. But they're different in the way that they reason about the problem. But they are the same in that they both are hinging upon one singular conflict, and that is the conflict between a perfectly good and omnipotent God and the existence of evil. And so the answer actually to both of them can be the same answer. In fact, if we can resolve the conflict between the friction, or if we can get rid of the friction between the idea of a perfectly good and omnipotent God and the existence of evil, then both problems are simultaneously solved. All right, they hinge upon the same problem. But also, there's an interesting article that I read fairly recently that these guys made this statement. They said that almost all such discussions on the problem of evil center around or begin with or emphasize a very serious logical tension, exactly as I just said, and that allegedly faces those theists who believe that God is omnipotent and perfectly good. And so I'm citing this, if for no other reason, just to say that I know I teach at a community college, but here are some other guys that are top scholars on this that can back my point up. So there you go. All right. Now, the logical problem is actually very straightforward. It's a really simple one to state. It's that you cannot have any, or you cannot eat your cake and have it too. You can't have all three of these be true at the same time. At most, you can only have two. And so the three beliefs are God is omnipotent, The second one is God is perfectly good. Third one is evil exists. You cannot have all three of those at the same time, is what the logical problem argues. Now, what, though, does not follow from that? Just to throw that question out there. If we can only have two of those at any one time, what does not follow from that? Well, that's definitely true. Let me rephrase it. When an atheist puts forward this argument, does an atheist prove the point if two of these, any two, can be true? Not necessarily. Atheism doesn't follow even if we grant the argument up front. Because God is omnipotent, God is perfectly good, evil exists. Let's say evil exists and God is perfectly good. We just allow those two, but we deny omnipotence. Does that deny that God exists? No. How about we allow for evil to exist and for God to be omnipotent? We just deny that he's perfectly good. Does that still allow that God exists? It still does, right? And so the threat of the argument is a little bit rashly concluded to be such that atheism necessarily follows, right? Atheism doesn't necessarily follow from this. But what does follow, and here's the problem of it, it at the very least requires a diminished sense of who God is. We can't affirm perfect orthodoxy if we are going to affirm only two of those and not three. And of course, the argument also says that we really can't just pick both issues or both doctrines of God's nature that we want and just deny evil, because evil obviously exists. So we have to include that one. And this was proposed first by a guy by the name of J.L. Mackey. And I say it was proposed first by him. If we really want to go back in the history of philosophy, there's an ancient Greek by the name of Epicurus that who allegedly proposed something like this. At the very least, early church fathers were aware of it. And so when we say that J.L. Mackey was the first person to propose it, he's the first noteworthy modern philosopher to propose it. We should just say it that way. C.S. Lewis's book, The Problem of Pain, was actually written at something like 13, 14, 15 years before Mackey actually published his article anyway. And so Lewis was addressing the same issue, and Lewis was very aware of it. It's not that we went for thousands of years and nobody thought of the problem of evil. But nevertheless, he states it this way. He says, in its simplest form, the problem is this. God is omnipotent. God is wholly good, and yet evil exists. There seems to be some contradiction between these three propositions, such that any two of them were true, or if any two of them were true, the third would be false. Exactly as I've been saying, that's how he states it. And, Now, the thing is, how many of you guys are familiar with any sort of logic course? Have anybody taken a logic course in here? A few of you guys? Awesome. All right, so I'm going to go over something that you guys have probably already heard. But as far as for the rest of you, just a brief little digression into logic, partially because it's my favorite subject. But all right, a contradiction is stated, as I have it in parentheses there, A and not A. All right. Oh, I've got markers. I love it when I have markers and I teach logic. That's just amazing. All right. So I don't need it. I already got it up on the board. All right. So A and not A. So the thing is, you have A and you have the negation of it. That is a pure contradiction. You cannot affirm and deny the same thing at the same time. All right. Now the thing about this is, when we say God is not good, what is the opposite of that? God is good, right? When we say God is not omnipotent, what is the opposite of that? God is omnipotent. So when we say So the inverse is also true. When we say God is omnipotent, the opposite is God is not omnipotent. So it's not a contradiction, though. That's what I'm getting at. The opposite is not that God doesn't exist. If evil comes up, what is the opposite of evil? Good, right? Not God, definitionally, right? So in this sense, there's no contradiction, and he admits this. In which case, the argument is slightly more nuanced. It's that it's rational to believe, though, that God doesn't exist. And that's a slightly different thing to prove. Right? Now, if we're going to say, okay, fine, we're taking a logical stance here, we're taking a rigid stance saying that God has to exist and he has to be good, J.L. Mackey's coming along and he's saying it's rational to believe that he isn't, because you don't want to give up any of that. I don't care that there's no literal logical contradiction. You don't want to give up any of those two qualifications, that he's omnipotent and that he's perfectly good. So given that you don't want to give up any two of them, he says it's rational to believe that God's just defeated. Right, because if you can't give up two, you're giving up all of them. All right. Now, He says then, however, the contradiction does not arise immediately. To show it, we need some additional premises. These additional principles are that God is opposed to evil in such a way that a good thing always eliminates evil as far as it can. And that's essential right there. A good thing will always eliminate evil as far as it can. And that there is no limit to what an omnipotent thing can do. That's the definition of omnipotence. From these, it follows that a good and omnipotent thing eliminates evil completely. Then the propositions that a good and omnipotent thing exists and that evil exists are incompatible. So we're looking at it from the effects, right? We're looking at it from a sinful, fallen world. And we're saying that if God exists, he should stamp out all the evil that exists. Clearly, that hasn't happened. And so we can infer from that effect that there isn't the cause that we were claiming, right? So, again, there's the deductive argument as he's putting it. Now, there have been a number of responses, and I'm going to fly through these pretty quickly because we also have the evidential one, and that's a bit longer because it's a bit more complicated. But there have been a number of responses, and in fact, probably the most famous one comes from C.S. Lewis. I'm just going to skip ahead to that. It comes from C.S. Lewis, all right? Now, C.S. Lewis states in a number of different places, he wrestles with it, and he wrestles with it in a very insightful way because he foresees somebody like a J.L. Mackey coming along, and he reasons, to quote him, God has made it a rule for himself that he won't alter people's character by force. He can and will alter them, but only if the people will let him. In that way, he has really and truly limited his power. Sometimes we wonder why he has done so or even wish he hadn't. All right. Now, he also states it more bluntly. Actually, I think I got it. Oh, yeah, I do. It continues. He apparently he thinks it worth doing, but would rather have a world free of free beings with all its risks than a world of people who did not who did right like machines because they didn't have any other choice, really. So this is called the free will defense. All right. We've all heard the free will defense, and it basically says something to the effect of because God allows freedom or human freedom, he cannot prevent there from being a world that exists with sin, with some sort of evil in it. All right. And so in this response, Lewis actually explicitly states in The Problem of Pain, he actually says that this is a limit to omnipotence. All right. So he gives an answer to the problem of evil. But what does he say? Well, he actually, in a sense, affirms something that J.L. Mackey said. Because J.L. Mackey said you cannot have all three of these be true at the same time. What does Lewis say? Lewis says, it is objected that the ultimate loss of a single soul means the defeat of omnipotence. And so it does. In creating a being with free will, omnipotence from the outset submits to a possibility of such a defeat. All right? Now, that's the standard, I think it's HarperCollins publication, I think that's the only one you can get at Barnes & Noble, so that's if you want to look that up, that's on page 129 of his Problem of Pain. But if we grant this, Lewis is answering Mackey's objection, in a sense, by affirming that Mackey is onto something. But he gives a qualified way for how omnipotence is limited. Let me ask you guys this, does that refute Mackey? Who thinks that refutes Mackey? Nobody? Okay. A couple of you? All right. Who thinks that it doesn't refute Mackey? Quite a few more? All right. How many of you are not fully awake? All right. Awesome. Yeah, I feel you. All right.
That's the best answer
you did. Yep. And the thing is, for the people who aren't awake at all, they just wouldn't raise their hands anyway, so that just follows. All right. So Lewis hasn't exactly refuted the problem. In a sense, he's actually affirmed what Mackey said in the beginning. All right. Now, for some, that's an acceptable answer. For others, it's not an acceptable answer. And for a lot of people who hold to the more classical view of God, that's not actually an acceptable answer. So other people have come along, most notably this guy. Who knows who that is? Alvin Plantinga, right? The great Christian philosopher, basically, who is single-handedly responsible for bringing back the philosophy of religion. And so we all have tremendous respect for Alvin Plantinga. And he put forth what is in the academic world, I think, the most famous version of this defense. And it's still the free will defense. But what Plantinga hopes to do is slightly more nuanced than what Lewis hopes to do. Lewis just admits up front, yeah, it's a limit to omnipotence. Plantinga doesn't actually want to concede that it's a real limit to omnipotence. And so what he wants to do is he wants to say there's no logical problem. And by this I mean that can God create a square circle? Well, no, that's not a logically possible thing, and so it's not a limit to his power to say that he can't do something that's logically impossible, right? And so if it's not a logical possibility for God to create a world in which case sin does not exist, then it's no real limit to his omnipotence or to his power to say that he can't do that. So that's what Plantinga hopes to achieve with this argument. And for those of you who are familiar with his free will defense, one of the proposals I actually gave for this conference was that I just go over that one entirely by itself. And the thing is, if it were to be sufficiently presented, I would probably need at least a full hour to do so, because it is a very complex argument. So that being said, if you're familiar with it, I'm giving a very, very watered-down version of his argument here for sake of time. And so it's not going to be technically correct, but it's going to give you the flavor of his argument, all right? So Plantinga gives this free will defense, and he, as he always does, he's not wanting to say, this is true. He's wanting to say, this is reasonable to believe, that it's still reasonable to believe in a perfectly good, omnipotent God and the existence of evil at the end of the day. All right, so he's not trying to prove that it's true, necessarily. So he restates the problem from the beginning with this premise. If God is all-powerful, he can possess the power to actualize whatever world he desires. Now, I need to take a step back and explain what he's talking about when he says world. He's talking about possible worlds. How many of you guys have heard this term before, possible worlds? All right, good. So, yeah, Stephen, you better raise your hand on that one. Yeah, so possible worlds, the way he talks about a possible world is qualified in the book that he actually proposes this argument in. And it's qualified in the beginning of the book. This argument is at the back of the book. And so he's assuming all the terminology that he's developed up until this point. And so if it's kind of a little bit dense terminology, I apologize. He qualified it in like 200 pages before, or 150 pages beforehand, all right? So a possible world is something like a state of affairs. And a state of affairs is a technical term. The easiest sort of, it's more than this, but the easiest way to think of it up front, I think, would be just to think of an event, all right? Or think of a way things could have been, all right? And then extend that to be a total and complete way things could have been. An alternative reality. Just think of it like that. An alternative way God could have created the whole of human affairs. All right? That is a possible world. And so when Plantinga is talking about God could have actualized whatever world he wants, what Plantinga says is, first off, he says this. This might actually be a bit of a rub for some people, but he says that God did not create the possible worlds. He merely actualized them. Or one of them, actually. He just actualized one. So when we talk about God bringing about the existence of this reality right now, it's his actualizing of it, not his creating it, would be how Plantinga would make the distinction. And so God is looking out at this vast number, literally infinite number, of possible worlds, possible way things could have been, and he chose to actualize this one. But he says, as Plantinga says, God could actualize whichever one of this infinite possibility he wants. All right. The second aspect of it is that God is all good and would desire to actualize a world without evil and suffering. That's sort of a way to restate what Mackey has earlier stated. So that seems to be, at least at this point, uncontroversial. All right. So Plantinga adds an essential qualification here that God cannot do anything that's not logically possible. All right. So that's something I already mentioned, but it's essential to his argument. All right. So can God just create any world? Or can he just actualize any world? The answer is, no, he cannot. Right? He cannot actualize any world because there are some worlds that are just not possible. Right? So he's got a whole bunch of different qualifications to show how that can be. And this is the simplest way I can put it. There's a whole lot more to this. There's things like trans-world depravity and so forth that he talks about. But let's just keep it with these simple terms. He has this example of a guy named Curly. All right, and Curly encounters this one state of affairs. All right, and Curly, in this state of affairs, keeps doing something that's wrong in all of the worlds except for one. All right, so he does. Let's say Curly only is a very unfortunate person. Only exists in four possible worlds. All right, he only has four possible realities. So Curly exists in these, and world two is the only world where he actually doesn't commit this wrongdoing when he encounters this particular state of affairs. The example that Plantinga gives is that he basically takes a bag of lost money, right? And so the question is, if Curly encounters this one state of affairs where he finds like $1 million just lost, and he's faced with the proposition, what do you do? Do you turn it in to the authorities or do you keep it for yourself? the morally right thing being to give it to the authorities, the morally wrong thing being to keep it for yourself, Plantinga theorizes that Curly in three out of the four worlds would choose actually to keep the money for himself, because that's just who Curly is. And then in the second world, though, he actually does do the right thing and he gives it to the authorities. Now, all of these possibilities are logically possible. There's no contradiction that's conceivable in Curly acting that way. But Plantinga then adds essentially, this is my terminology, but he adds essentially another qualification, all right, that there's a difference between a logically possible world. Well, I'll read his quote before I get to that. If a person S is, I love analytic quotes like this. If a person S is free with respect to a given action, then he is free to determine or to perform that action and free to refrain. No causal laws and antecedent conditions determine either that he will perform the action or that he will not. It's worth going into this. I'm running out of time too fast, but it's worth going into this, I think. All right. So the thing about this that we need to understand is that no causal laws and antecedent conditions mean that there's nothing inherent to the world beyond Curly himself and his own freedom that causes him to do whatever action that he takes. It's not that being in that world causes Curly to be good or bad. It's not that the world determines Curly to be good or bad. It's that Curly determines himself to be good or bad, and that it's just not logically impossible for Curly to actually be bad in all worlds, right? It's logically possible still. So he's free, and his freedom allows for him to be bad. All right? No causal antecedent cause also includes God. So there's no providential control over Curly's actions, according to Plantinga here. All right? I'm just going to skip ahead to it. So what he's saying is, effectively, if you're going to think about these worlds, yes, there's four possible worlds that God could actualize, but there's only three feasible ones. Because the fact is that Curly, if given freedom, would always actually choose, by his nature, to keep the money and not turn it into the authorities. In which case, God, insofar as he actualizes a free Curly, will always be actualizing a guy who will sin. All right, and that ends up getting into this issue of transworld depravity, which is basically a depravity that extends across multiple possible worlds and so forth. But the simplest way to put this, though, is that God never actually had an option, a realistic option, to actualize world two, wherein there's no sin. And so it's just about as improbable as God actualizing a square circle, something like that. All right, it's not a real possibility for God. So can God create just any world? The answer is no. So therefore, as Plantinga puts it, of course it is up to God whether to create free creatures at all. But if he aims to produce moral good, then he must create significantly free creatures upon whose cooperation he must depend. Thus is the power of an omnipotent God limited by the freedom he confers upon his creatures. All right. So again, when he says limited there, he thinks he's not saying anything that's particularly against God's omnipotence. God hasn't actually been limited in his omnipotence, but in a manner of speaking, he is limited. All right, he cannot actualize any possible world. And so Plantinga also, to a degree, affirms in a very qualified sense Mackey's first objection, that you do have to limit omnipotence in some way. However, Plantinga gives us a rational way to limit omnipotence. If you buy that or not, we can talk about that after the presentation, but I got to move on because I just spent 20 minutes on this one and the next one's going to take 30. So, all right. The evidential problem of evil is a completely different problem. So the logical problem says that it's just not logical to believe in God because of certain qualifications about his nature and about the nature of evil. The evidential problem says that it's not probable. It's not that it's logically incompatible, it's just not probable to believe in God. That if we survey what happens in the world, the reality is that the world doesn't seem to reveal it doesn't reveal that God's existence is very likely at all. Right? That's the evidential problem, that the evidence gives us a different reality or a different picture of reality. And this is proposed by a guy by the name of William Rowe, and he actually is frequently called, or actually called himself, the friendly atheist. Now the reason why he said that is because he didn't want to come across as somebody who is just angry with God or something like that, or who just hates religion or something like that. He says that actually he believes religion can even still, and Christianity specifically, can still be rational at the end of the day. He's just saying that he thinks it's more rational to be an atheist for this very reason. And that actually is in keeping, remember, with this is a probabilistic argument. This is not a certain definitive logical argument. All right. So he begins with the premise that we're familiar with by now. There exist instances of intense suffering. Oh, sorry, different premise. there exist instances of intense suffering which an omnipotent, omniscient being could have prevented without thereby losing some greater good or permitting some evil equally bad or worse. All right, what he's saying is that every act of suffering, every act of evil is, that there exist certain acts of evil that there is no reason for. There's no explanation that can be given that can get God off the out of the docks, in a sense. That there... Say what?
He sounds all-knowing to me.
Oh, Roe? Well, so that's actually one of the responses that gets given to him. And so he's saying that the premise one is that there are instances of evil that we can't provide an explanation for. Why? Because there is no explanation. The tendency is for people to say, okay, God allowed this evil to allow a greater good to happen. He's just proposing the contrary thesis. Well, no, there are certain instances that there's no conceivable explanation for. Right? If we're, as he would put it, if we're rational, we won't see an explanation for it. All right. Premise two, an omniscient holy good being would prevent the occurrence of any intense suffering it could, unless it could not do so without thereby losing some greater good or permitting some evil equally bad or worse. Premise two is basically this. It is that God will always have a good reason for allowing whatever evils that happen. All right. So the first one is a contradiction to the second one, in a sense. All right. So he concludes, therefore, there does not exist an omnipotent, omniscient, holy good being. If we affirm one, we cannot affirm two. If we affirm the first one here, the second one is a contradiction. Yes?
What's the primary source of this argument?
I can give you the... these are actually direct quotes out of The Problem of Evil and Some Varieties of Atheism by William L. Rowe, R-O-W-E. Well, it's up there. Yeah. Yeah. Also, if you're just interested... The Problem of Evil, edited by Marilyn McCord Adams and Robert Merrihew Adams, is basically, it contains all the major writings on the Problem of Evil. So, yeah. So, all right. So, so he concludes, it's rational to believe that God does not, or that such a being does not exist. Now, we also have to keep in mind, he is adding together, and before we separated God's omnipotence and his goodness in our definition of God, we're saying that these are two aspects of God. Now, Roe is combining both of those together, and he's saying that God is, if we're going to believe in God, God has to be omnipotent, and at the same time, he has to be all good. And so, therefore, he's rejecting God outright. But again, rejecting God outright does not follow from his argument, because it just follows that that particular qualification, if we grant that he is correct in his argument, it just follows that that qualification of God is not correct. Right? But we don't even have to go that far, necessarily. So why does Roe conclude number three? Because it seems like, in a sense, one argument that's been given against him is that he just prefers the first premise to the second premise. There are two contradictory premises premises, and he just says, well, the first one has more weight to me than the second. And that essentially that's all that his argument consists of. So why does he conclude three? Well, as Roe puts it, it's obvious that three exists. You can't deny it. It's just a fact. Was that an argument? Or is that an assertion? All right. Now, he affirms that there are intense instances of pointless suffering. He just says that that's the case up front. And the immediate response, well, I'll get to that in just a second. He says, to quote him, for two claims, only if an omniscient holy good being permits intense suffering, then either there is some greater good that would have been lost or some equally bad or worse evil that would have occurred had the intense suffering been prevented. But then he gives a famous example, and it's put forth, the argument takes this form. It's a conditional. You see the arrow in that example, and the arrow means if-then. So every time you see arrow, just think if-then. And the type of form of the argument is called modus tollens. All right. Now, modus tollens takes this form, that if P, then Q, not Q, therefore not P. A way to qualify this would be to say, if it's raining outside, it will be wet. It's not wet outside, therefore, it's not raining. Think of it in that sense, all right? So his argument is very similar to that. Roe's argument is an application of modus tollens. If evil happens, then God had a reason for letting it happen. God could not have had a reason for letting it happen, therefore, evil doesn't happen. No, it doesn't really follow that way. But that's still the way he puts it structurally in the book. In a sense, yeah, it could be. I think it could be construed that way. I think what he's reliant on, though, and he does say this. He actually says, "I haven't definitively proven this." Who actually asked the question? Was that you? Yeah, he actually admits, "I haven't definitively logically proven this." If you want to really press the logic, it doesn't necessarily hold. But he's saying that it's enough of a sufficient reason to support that inference, nevertheless. So if you say it's
okay.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any logical reason.
He actually concedes that in that article. Yes, he does. That's sort of the deep, dark secret of the whole, yeah, of the whole argument. But so, what's the defeater argument? The defeater is that there are instances of pointless suffering in the world. He just asserts this over and over again, and then he gives an example. This is a famous example that he gives, and that's why I got the flaming forest in the background. Suppose in some distant forest, lightning strikes a dead tree, resulting in a forest fire. In the fire, a fawn is trapped, horribly burned, and lies there in terrible agony for several days before death relieves it of its suffering. So far as we can see, the fawn's intense suffering is pointless.
Except to make his point.
So what?
Except to make his point.
Except, yeah, exactly. It's from a divine standpoint, it would seem pointless. So let's think about this. All right?
That's evil, isn't it?
Yeah, that's evil. Imagine Bambi, poor little Bambi here burning to death. Right? What could be the point of that? There you go. That was the... Yes. Amen. All right. that was awesome, but pure heartless. I'm just saying. All right. Roe ends up basically saying, look at this horrible instance, and what kind of a person would say there actually was a purpose for that, right? That he just basically thinks that this is enough of an assertion that the opposite will follow. Now, as I'm pretty sure for most of you here, that's not strong enough. He's basically asserting by sheer force of his will that this argument, that this thesis, that pointless evil happens, overpowers everything you people can say. That's basically the full extent of his argument. And the problem is, that's very persuasive to a lot of people. And if it is persuasive to the person, how do you argue them out of it is a little bit of the issue, because that's more of an emotional persuasion than a rational one. And my mentor is always saying, you can never reason a person out of a belief the person did not reason their way into. And there's a bit of truth to that, right? But anyway, continuing on with William Roe. William Roe states that the truth is that there is not a position to prove that one is true. He concedes that. He just conceded that his whole assertion isn't provable. We cannot know with certainty that instances of suffering of the sort described in 1 do occur in our world. But it is one thing to know or prove that one is true, and quite another to have rational grounds for believing that one is true. All right? And he is correct in that. There are plenty of things that we can't prove that we do believe on rational grounds anyway. There are instances of pointless suffering. If God existed, there would be no instances of pointless suffering. Therefore, there is no God. All right. Now, he proposes a counterargument. He thinks this is what people will say. And he actually addresses this in the book as well, or in his article. He proposes the counterargument that there is a God. We could begin as most Christians will begin. There is a God. God would seek to prevent all instances of pointless suffering, therefore there are no instances of pointless suffering. Now, I'm pretty sure for most of you hearing Roe's argument, your immediate response is actually probably something like that. That you hear his response, you say, well, no, we just may not know what the reason is for God to allow this instance of what looks like pointless suffering, but we know because God exists and because God is perfectly good that it's not ultimately pointless. All right? That's the gist of the argument. And Roe actually just, again, asserts his first premise. He says, no, there is obviously, you are irrational if you think that there's anything other than pointless suffering. And it ends up becoming this sort of bickering match. You know, just like, there is pointless suffering. There isn't pointless suffering. No, there is. No, you're irrational. No, you're irrational. It just kind of goes back and forth like that. Right? So clearly, in his view, the counterargument is false. Now, there's a response by Stephen Wickstra that is actually also in that book, if you're interested. And Roe has replied to Wickstra, and it's an interesting little response. And the thing is, with the articles themselves, I don't know if any of you are very familiar with reading analytic philosophy, but it makes these statements frequently, or analytic philosophers make statements that are borderline unintelligible in the fact that they're basically so rigidly logical, quasi-mathematical, that they basically, you've just got to read them for hours before they'll make sense to you. All right? Stephen's written on his head because we had to read the same articles in our Problem of Evil class not that long ago. So the thing is, Wickstra's argument can actually be reduced to a fairly simple response. And Wickstra basically says we are simply not in the position to be able to determine in any moment whether it was purposeful or not, whether the suffering that was involved was allowed by God for some divine good reason or not. We just simply don't know enough. And that he actually backs it up with a fairly persuasive argument that is to say there's plenty of things that we cannot actually know for certain about, but that we rationally just infer anyway. And so this begins a movement that's known as skeptical theism. There's a whole lot of writings on this particular thesis that have been popping up in recent years. And this view basically says that we will just suspend judgment on the first premise, on the premise that there are instances of gratuitous suffering. Basically, the skeptical theist will say, well, we just don't know if there are. And in the event that we don't know if there are, that's basically Wickstra's response. In the event that we don't know that there, if there are or if they're not, because it falls well beyond our ability to know, then we're just going to affirm the theistic commitments that we had affirmed for other reasons unrelated to the problem of evil. We already believe that God exists, we believe that God is perfectly good, and we believe that God is omnipotent. And so, given that we can rationally suspend judgment as to whether or not there is gratuitous evil or not, then we will do so and still affirm God being as we said he was in the beginning. Now, I don't know if that'll be satisfying to everybody here, but that, again, has gained a whole lot of traction in recent years in response to William Rowe, which is actually a fairly good argument in this regard. Before, William Rowe is asserting that, yes, it's ultimately going to come down to a shouting match if we're just going to say there is gratuitous evil, there isn't gratuitous evil. It's just going to go back and forth like that. But he says, I think that it's more rational to believe that one is true. The counter argument by Wickstra says we haven't got we do not have the ability to say for certain, in which case there is no way that Rowe can determine one to be more rational than the other. Right? It's just an assertion of pure will. All right. So the reply to Wickstra was basically this, and I think this is probably the weakest argument Rowe makes yet, not to completely be blunt about it. Rowe basically says that if it's reasonable to doubt the first premise, that there are instances of gratuitous evil, why is it not equally reasonable to doubt God's existence? He just throws that out, sort of as if this is a real argument. It's actually a bit of a fallacy because he's trying to say that Wickstra's being a hypocrite, but he says, why believe theism at all? The charge is this, Wickstra is guilty of selectively doubting. Because Wickstra says, basically, we have an epistemic limit. We have an inability of our knowledge to know all things and to know certain types of things. And so, Stephen, was that not like the most maddening part when you got to it? When Rowe responds like that, you kind of want to say, I don't believe in God because of some conclusion I drew from the problem of evil. I believed in God before I came to the problem of evil, which is why evil is a problem in the first place. In which case, this whole argument, why do you not suspend doubt on, or why do you not suspend judgment on the belief in God? Well, because I believe in God for other reasons. Right? It has nothing to do with the problem of evil for why I believe it up front. And so when Wickstra replied to this, which is unfortunately not in the book, but if any of you guys have a JSTOR account, you can find it pretty easily. When Wickstra replies, that's exactly what he points out. He says this response of hypocrisy that I'm just selectively doubting doesn't make any sense. All right. Now, I got through that a bit quicker than I was expecting. Yay. That means I can now get to the next one. All right. The thesis that God and evil are irreconcilable is one that a whole lot of people have tried to solve. We've just seen Plantinga and Lewis try to solve it. We more just briefly touched on their answers, but there's another answer, or another type of answer. What about Thomas Aquinas' answer? You guys will probably hear a lot about him today. And the thing about Thomas Aquinas is he gives about four or five different answers to the problem of evil, and he gives them at different points in his works. And the thing about it is, I actually think his answer is ultimately, if you wanted to take a meta perspective on it, if you wanted to take a step back and look at it, his answer is ultimately something more like this. If you guys will fully develop your systematic theology, the problem of evil just disappears. It's not that it's necessarily refuted. It's just it's dissolved. It never really shows up in the first place. So you can take different pieces of his argument, but his arguments always show up as part of his overall systematic theology. And so the answer is essentially that the problem of evil is dissolved by a proper systematic theology. And if you wanted a more Protestant person, somebody like a Charles Hodge would ultimately put forth a very similar sort of thesis. All right. Francis Cheriton, the early reformer, would also put forth a very similar sort of thesis, but he's largely appealing to Aquinas on this issue. So it's kind of the same one. But anyway, Aquinas gives several different accounts for it, several different arguments, and I'm going to give you my favorite piece of one of his arguments. All right? And this is meant to refute this main point, that there is a logical contradiction between affirming evil and God as a perfectly good, perfectly omnipotent being at the same time. If I can demonstrate that there is no friction there, that there is no contradiction there, then I can affirm both easily without actually having any sort of rational or irrational aspect of my thought. So Aquinas begins, as he always does, by asking this sort of question. Well, what do we mean by the terms that we're using? What do we mean by the terms good? What do we mean by the terms evil? What do we mean by the term God? Like, we need to qualify these first before we can give a rational answer. Because if you've noticed, a lot of these arguments just sort of posit God and then just sort of posit a whole lot of things about God and then just sort of say, but that can't be true, so now we're just going to reject that. Right? They're sort of treating it in a less technical sense. And so he begins with God is an infinitely perfect, infinitely good being. We know that part already. And God is, but it's more than that. God is pure, simple, subsistent being whose nature it is to be and from whom all being comes. Right? There would be no existence without God. And God's nature is pure existence. Now, that's essential. You need to keep that part in mind. Because as Aquinas is putting it, if we know properly who God is, then the whole answer falls out of that. All right? What is the nature of perfection? Well, perfection is lacking nothing. This he gets from Aristotle. That Aristotle says that he has this idea of the golden mean, which he said is neither too much nor too little. It's the perfect amount. And so perfect is no excess. It's no deficiency. And so perfection is lacking nothing. It is complete. All right? That's what he means by perfection when he uses that. So when we say that God is a perfectly good being, we mean that he is lacking no goodness, right? He's complete. Also, goodness, it's that which brings about perfection, all right? Now, there's several different senses of goodness that we can use here, or that Aquinas puts forth because he's drawing from Aristotle on this as well. This is the definition we're using for now, all right? Now, what is the nature of evil? And here's, the most important part. That when we talk about evil before, it's always difficult to try to understand what exactly is meant by it. Is it a positively qualified thing? Is it a negatively qualified thing? Well, Aquinas says it's not a positive force, right? It's not a positive thing. Evil is what he calls a privation. It's a lack in a thing, all right? And so think of it as, for example, the common example that you will find is that a privation is like blindness in the eye, right? A negation would just negate the eye. A privation is negating some aspect that the eye should have, right? So blindness doesn't negate the eye. It just negates the proper function of the eye there, all right? So evil is just a lack within the thing, right? Now, the question could be then, as it's been the whole time, is the nature of God and the nature of evil, are they contradictory things here? And the answer is yes, they are. God cannot behave in a way that is at all wicked. How does that follow? Well, if it is his nature to be, and if evil is defined as an imperfection, which is qualified as a lack of being, a lack in being, and also we affirm that God is simple, which means that he is uncomposed. He does not have parts. We cannot just negate some part of God because there's no part to negate. You either have to negate all of him or none of him. All right? So if that's the case, then when we posit this notion of evil as a lack in a thing, then it is a logical contradiction to ever affirm that God could be capable of evil. All right? It's just a contradiction outright. But does this negate evil? No, it doesn't. Evil actually still can be posited right alongside of God. We can just never say that God is evil. Right? So the second part is God can cause evil without himself being evil. How is that possible? Well, the way Aquinas puts it is that he doesn't issue forth a fullness in being. If all being and all fullness in being comes from God, then God can also withhold a perfection. Now, when he withholds a perfection, that doesn't mean that he's actively causing something to be evil. He's withholding the good. All right, it's the difference between primary and secondary causation here. That primary causation is issuing forth being, and no issuing forth of being can ever be bad. Secondary causation is withholding a good, and when that happens, the result is a bad thing that he's withholding the good from. All right, so. Yeah, primary cause is imparting the fullness, secondary cause withholding a good. All right, so then the next question would be, why is there evil? All right, you could still ask that question, why is there evil? Okay, we've shown that it's not contradictory to say that God and evil can't exist at the same time. It's just contradictory to say that God could be evil. Right? We've shown that. But the question could still be asked, why is there evil? Now, given that God is infinitely simple, or infinite and simple, he is uncomposed, he is infinite, then that would also follow that his reasons are infinite and simple, right? They're infinite and uncomposed. Now, can any of us fathom an infinite answer? No. Can we fathom a part of a simple infinite answer? No. So when it comes to why did God cause any sort of evil to happen, why did he allow any sort of evil to happen, the answer has to be immediately, well, actually, we can't know why. And this is interesting, I think, especially because what happens when we turn to the book of Job? At the end of Job, Job's been asking, the whole question of Job is, why do bad things happen to good people? And so you've been waiting for just forever with that book. Why in the world has God not shown up yet and just answered this problem? And then at the very end, God shows up, and what does he say? Yeah, he says, stop asking stupid questions. I'm not going to give you this answer. Do I owe you an answer? I don't owe you an answer. Were you there when I created all things? He answers it in that way. In which case, that's completely, what Aquinas is arguing is results in a very similar sort of answer. We just simply can't know. We're not in a position to know. Right? God's reasonings are his own. And we just do not have the ability to answer them, or to fathom them, rather. All right. I've got a few more slides, but I think I'm good enough now to take about 10 minutes of questions, since I know that there's probably going to be some. I also know I rushed through that, so I apologize for that, but I hope to get through all the material. So, questions, go for it. Yeah, I'll get to you in just a second.
I haven't taken a logic course.
Okay.
So that's where I'm coming from.
Okay.
But when I think about this problem, evil, what does evil act upon? It acts upon human beings. Mm-hmm. There's been no statement made about humans. It's just been an assumption that we die. If we are eternal beings, then what you may have to redefine evil, because evil can't cause any harm to eternal beings.
Why not?
Why should it?
What do you mean, why should it?
Because you don't die.
Yeah, but, well...
But pain is experience.
Yeah.
And that's a teacher. But you never die.
So you're denying that evil ever happens?
Evil happens to teach us. But if we're an eternal being, we just experience it.
But you're still affirming that evil happens, though.
Yes, it does.
Because that's all somebody like William Rowe would need, or that's all somebody like a Mackey would need. It's just the initial affirmation that evil does happen.
But God would cause it to happen for our education as eternal beings.
And so in that sense, you're basically giving the counter thesis that Rowe anticipated then. You're saying basically God exists. God would not allow there to be gratuitous evil. Therefore, there is no gratuitous evil. Right? That's basically what you're arguing, isn't it?
He would let evil exist, but it's there to teach us, because we can't die, so we can't be harmed.
He would let evil, but not gratuitous evil, right?
Okay. Well,
yeah. So you're affirming basically what Roe was anticipating as an objection, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I don't know the logic for that.
Okay. Yeah.
I wanted to lead to that preface, because I knew I'd get there.
Yeah. I'll get to you in just a second. You had your hand raised earlier? Yeah.
Can there be evil without God?
It depends on how you qualify it. That's a whole presentation in and of itself. Because the thing is, if we affirm that evil is a privation in a thing, while it would make the most sense, and I think ultimately you're getting into a cosmological argument there for God's existence, to say that you would have to have God existing in order for there to be like a privation in a thing. You could go that direction with it, but I mean, just the simple claim that evil is a lack in a thing doesn't initially smack of there being a God causing the thing.
So well, the lack of a thing that should have been there to begin with.
Right.
So that means now you're starting to set a standard, right?
Right.
Because it is not just the lack of a thing. Like if a rock doesn't have eyes, yeah, but
right.
if a newborn doesn't have eyes,
right.
That's
a there's a privation, exactly.
So now you're starting to set standards.
Exactly. And the thing is that I've read a number of... I'm sympathetic to what you're saying. I'm not trying to refute that at all or argue against it. But I have read a number of Darwinians who've responded by saying, well, the simple process of this Darwinian evolution is that there are always going to be these privations in the things. Right? That's why we're evolving, getting better. Right? And so if we're getting better, it implies that there was a deficiency, in which case they could still affirm some sort of evil in the form of a privation in some sense. So then we would have to take the argument over to like a cosmological argument or something like that. And there's a lot of them that do that. Yeah, I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying that if you were to propose that, you might get that pushback at some point. So that's just all I'm saying. But yes.
Have you had a chance to read it or review Bart Ehrman's book, God's Problem?
Yeah, that was actually I read that before I was a philosophy major. He proposes Epicurus's version of the argument in there, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's a fascinating book. It's personal school reading. And,
yeah.
It just seems. Grabby. A child dies in 2008 at 105 minutes.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm really kind of skeptical of which was, like, it's hard to know. We can't know if there's gratuitous suffering. It seems pretty hard to tell to swallow. I mean,
and that's actually entirely what Rose's argument sort of gambling on, that it'll be a tough pill to swallow. The argument itself is just simply asking, is it rational to believe something? And a conclusion being a hard pill to swallow doesn't make it irrational. So that needs to be assumed up front. So whether you accept it or not, I mean, that's up to you. But, I mean, the argument still does exist. So I'll get to you in just a second. Go ahead.
Have you thought of putting the question in the form of what is the problem of good? Why a good God would allow good to occur on a sinful rebellious earth.
Yeah, and there's definitely that one. That's just a different question. I mean, it's a very legitimate question. It's a great question, but it's a different question. So proposing a different question does not necessarily answer the problem of evil. So it'd just be another issue we need to talk about, and it's a great issue. So, yes, and you guys both raised your hands. I think you raised yours first, so go ahead.
So has anyone spoken to how this functions in the context of time? So we are subject to time. So our suffering over, the example of the deer in the forest, mm-hmm. over a period of days suffering, if, God is an omnipotent being, he exists outside of time.
Right.
How does that fit into this argument?
Would what you're asking, would it sort of have the contingent, or would it be something like, does it really matter in the grand scheme of things? Is that sort of it? Or what are you getting at?
Like, yeah, so like how long of a period of suffering constitutes big suffering, or how do you quantify suffering?
Definitely.
In that, how do you lead that into quantifying evil?
Yeah, so basically if you did a one-to-one relation of evil to suffering, all you need is one moment, one brief fleeting moment of evil for the problem to exist.
Infinitesimally small.
Yes, all you need is just any infinitesimally small moment of evil to exist for the problem to be there.
Okay.
Why would a perfectly good God even allow an infinitely small one? Because even that would seem to be contrary to his nature. I'll get to you in just a second. He had his hand raised. So,
my definition that evil is a lack of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Us being imperfect beings, us being created by God, wouldn't it follow that God created evil then?
In a sense, yes, but not in a morally culpable way.
Okay.
Yeah.
More so than created, allowed the existence.
Yeah,
of.
That's probably the better way to put it, yeah. So, your question?
Understand the different worlds.
Possible world stuff?
Yeah, I don't
yeah.
Think that.
Could
do a quick...
no. I'm sorry. That's, again, I wish I could, but
I've got a really good example.
Okay.
Go for it, yeah.
Have you ever looked into a mirror and then there was a mirror behind you. Do you see how, like, the row of mirrors goes down? Imagine if all of those functioned independently. It's a similar concept, a similar stream that connects you. However, you'd probably freak out if you saw every single instance of you doing something slightly different.
So this is sci-fi, like a
time. Quantum physics mostly.
Well, not necessarily. No, it's a logical thing. The multiverse theory is a different thing than possible world semantics. But possible worlds it's not actually even necessarily. It gets really muddy really quick. It's not even necessarily saying that these worlds exist, although most people would hold that they do. It's beginning by saying that most philosophers would hold that they do. It's all it's saying is that it's possible to think of such infinite possibilities here, right? That it's a logical possibility, not necessarily. It's definitely not an actual possibility, and so it leaves us with this whole metaphysical question of, well, then what are these? Where are these? Or something like that. So a lot of people just don't like possible world semantics, but
yeah. The Bible talks about the earth singular.
Right.
So if there would be plural, then would it be plural?
So Curly, in the example that was given, Curly would be just one person, right? But he would be one identity spread across an infinite number of possible ways he could have been. Would be how they would say it. So there would be just one Earth spread across an infinite number of possibilities there. He's got his hand raised. I'll get to you next.
Did you answer like which one you personally find most satisfying? Was it free will or just the get weakest
thing? Yeah, to be completely honest here, at the very end with 2 minutes left, I don't really buy the free will defense. I do think Aquinas' answer works. So, yeah. Yes?
So what if Roe or any atheist, what do they say is the main cause of evil? Where does it derive from in the first place?
They, that's an interesting question. They don't really go into that because they're
so
what?
So they don't want to go into it.
I don't even know if they want to so much as, I mean, I think at the end of their arguments, they would actually be warranted if they wanted to just say, okay, now that we've shown that God doesn't exist, there is no such thing as evil. And here's how I think they could justifiably do that, is that evil is only a concept, as you were arguing just a second ago, evil is only really a rational concept given the existence of a God. So it's only inconsistent to believe in if we also affirm the existence of God. I think that's what they're reasoning about, like, and so if we just deny God, then we're denying evil too, but I think they're willing to do that. So, and I think you had your hand first. So.
Can you say that evil exists by necessity? That, like, you have to have evil in the way that, like, to put it in vision form, like, it'd be incredible that everyone's super and no one is.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's what something like the free will argument would be trying to say. So she's asking, is it does evil necessarily have to exist for good to be good, kind of thing? And if evil is a lack in a thing, then no, it doesn't, actually. It wouldn't follow. And so some people would affirm that, and other people would not. I'm out of time. I can answer this in the hall if you'd like, and I can answer yours in the hall as well if you'd like. So sorry about that. I'm just out of time. Thank you. Appreciate it.